I've heard there was.
The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Just love God. Just love yourself. And just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. A lot going on. We have begun Lent, and I have a confession to make is that I know I'm not supposed to, but Lent, I find one of those really great seasons. And I mean, it's maybe my favorite season now. It used to be Advent, but now it's Lent. And everybody says, well, sacrifice, giving up stuff. Yeah, but it's a time to change the rhythm of your life, to kind of reset and to get things going again. And so I love it. So this is the first week of Lent, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the show. It's also, we're in the middle of the Winter Olympics, and I'm delighted in just a moment or two, we're going to have Rebecca Dussault on, who is an American cross-country skier who competed in the 20th Winter Olympic Games in Torino, Italy. And she's going to be a guest, and we're going to speak with her, and I'm delighted about that. And it's also coming up is President's Day. And so a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak about presidents, a little bit about politics. Ugh, not such a good thing to speak about these days, with Professor James O'Toole, who is from Boston College. So I am delighted. Thank you for joining us again on Just Love. I hope your Lent has gotten off to a good start and we'll begin it again. But I just want to get to our first guest, who is Rebecca Dussault, who is a American cross-country skier and competed in the 2006 Olympics. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Oh, you're so welcome. And yes, Just Love. I love the name. And good morning from snowy Idaho.
Snowy Idaho. Which part of Idaho are you in?
I'm in Sandpoint, way up north by the Canadian border.
That's like the skinny part?
It is. It is the skinny part, or the panhandle, as we call it.
So here's a question for you. If you're from Idaho, is the skinny part of Idaho skinnier than the skinny part of West Virginia, or is the skinny part of West Virginia skinnier than the skinnier part of Idaho?
Well, if you're talking about way up at Wheeling, West Virginia, that's about as skinny as it gets in my book. So I'm going to say West Virginia wins.
Okay. I never thought about it until you just mentioned you were from Idaho. So are you watching the Olympics?
I am. Between homeschooling the children and working on my business, I try to watch a little bit. You know, my days are pretty tightly scheduled, but I guess we have time for what we make time for. So, yeah, I've watched a few of the cross-country races in particular.
Okay, because that's what you did, right?
That is right, yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, most of us who aren't, you know, athletes and aren't trained athletes and all, when we think of skiing, we think of, ooh, go down the big hill, go down fast, all of that type of stuff. But that's not what cross-country skiing is about, is it?
No, cross-country skiing is a much greater full-body effort. It really taxes your cardiovascular system as well as your strength. And so those things simultaneously make it one of the hardest sports on earth. And I mean, there is a joke that circulates that real men ski uphill, but we won't go into that. but
I don't quite get
that. About it is we do. We ski uphill, we ski flats, we ski downhill, all on a very skinny ski, maybe 2 inches in width. And we do not have metal edges. So even though we use a lot of the same techniques to snowplow, to turn, to skate, the various things we do on alpine skis, it's a very different feeling because your gear is just heavier than a feather.
Well, you know, I'm not a skier, but when I was in high school 4 million years ago, I did go on a couple of ski trips with my class, and it was downhill skiing. But then, you know, probably 30 years ago or so, I did go cross-country skiing once, but only once. And so I at least kind of have a sense of what it is. And boy, from what you say, it is a very, very rigorous sport.
It is rigorous. And I was just lamenting the fact that I now look at the racers as they do their Olympic races, and I'm like exhausted watching them. I think partly just because I know that pain cave so well. But I literally sit there and I feel their pain, and I'm like, it's a little bit far removed from me because I haven't been racing at that level in a couple of years. But yeah, it's exhausting, but it's wonderful because it shows what the human spirit can do when it thinks it's done all it can do, and then it has to do a little bit more. And it's so applicable to the spiritual life. You know, we don't get to get soft ever as cross-country skiers. We don't even have an off-season to speak of. So really just constant application of self and donating yourself toward your goals. And that's, for me, sport is that school of moral excellence where we can learn the higher things.
So how long is the cross-country skiing race? Is it standard or are there different lengths?
There are different lengths, and things have changed over time to make it a little bit more media friendly. We're, of course, in competition with extreme sports, so we'll never be as exciting as some of those. But no longer do we head off into the woods for a 50-kilometer continuous ski race either. So with it being more made for television, we have smaller loops. The skiers return to the stadium in front of the fans several times, but then they head out on 2.5 or 3.5 kilometer loops. You'll notice everything is in kilometers. But our shortest race would be that of a sprint race, which is 1 kilometer. However, it's run much like track heats. Say you're running the 400, well, you might have the qualifying or then the quarters, the semis, and then the finals. So you'll race up to 4 times if you're racing fast that day. So it's maybe the most exhausting, but it's broken into the shortest, hardest segments possible. And then all the way up to women do a 30K in the Olympics. And outside the Olympics, there's a lot of different events that are 50K and even upwards of 90 kilometers. So it's kind of,
wow,
pick your passion.
How long does it take to do 50K?
50K, my fastest 50K is the American Birkebeiner in 2 hours and 16 minutes.
Okay, which is about the time of the fastest runners in a marathon, right?
That would be comparable for sure.
Yeah, and that's what's that? That's like 26 months. So it's a little bit shorter, but that is fascinating. So listen, you know, you talked about, and let's talk a little bit more about this. That in a certain sense, sports has a relationship to kind of the spiritual life, a spiritual discipline. Talk a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. There's a lot of parallelism between the spiritual walk and the conditioning we go through as athletes. One of the foundational things they have in common is suffering and how we deal with that. Day in and day out with training, you would encounter a lot of bodily suffering, especially. And so as the Christian, too, is not immune to suffering and to living in the pattern of our Lord, who certainly suffered. We're not looking for a ticket out or some escape in some way that it's all going to be perfect because, by gosh, we're Christians and, you know, we attract great wealth and energy and everything. No, it's not that at all. It's living in the pattern of our Lord, which is oftentimes suffering. And so understanding that sport is conditioning a harmony in the body that can seek the higher things. So not only is it conditioning it in the body, but then it has to flow out. This has to be bigger than ourselves. We see it now as we watch it on the Olympic stage, these athletes who do make it bigger than themselves and who do glorify God and who do put on display true human virtue, maybe not divine virtue, but human virtue. We get a great display of it from many of the athletes. And we also witness an incredible brotherhood. And I think sport promotes that too. When I saw North Korea and South Korean athletes holding hands to light the torch, that was really moving to me. I hope others felt that same way. So we get to see glimpses into a more perfected creation. And sport certainly should be taking us in those directions, because otherwise, I'm here to tell you, it's just a fleeting movement of the body. It's just a pleasure that passes. And maybe it's not even pleasurable if you are actually doing the suffering part. But we've got to use sport as that correct tool, or it's malformed. And that's what we're experiencing with a lot of Catholic families these days.
So we're speaking with Rebecca Dussault, who is American cross-country skier, who was in the 2006 Olympics. And she's a wife, she's a mother, she's a speaker, she's a trainer. And we're going to learn a little bit more about those things a little bit further on in our conversation. Rebecca, everything you've just said is really very, very inspiring. But we also hear, like, there's a dark side of all of this, too, whether it be, you know, some of the doping controversies in the Olympics. Like, I think the Russians aren't in it. And they also talk about, you know, some of the training or the amount of money that's needed to get somebody to the Olympics. And so there's a little bit of a tug there in trying to keep it the way it should be, and some of the kind of the demands maybe of the contemporary age.
You know, there's this constant pull back and forth. Is you know, dabbling in sports enough to gain the lessons that are available through it, which are pretty priceless, but also knowing how to discern when too much is too much. And we have it keenly in our faces with our children. Is like, we every weekend we could be running across the state for competitions, we could be splitting up the family, we could be missing mass, we could be chasing a perishable crown. And as much as I was heavily involved in that, I always balanced it with that imperishable crown, because that has to be the dictate for how we operate within sports. So, yeah, you see sport run amok. You see the grossest commercialistic expressions of it. There are sports I could name that I just absolutely will not even really view, because I just feel like they have corrupted sport so thoroughly to be what it is not meant to be for the human. Anyway, so at the Olympic level, yeah, we see that too. You know, alpine skiing, just the cost to ski on an alpine hill these days, or to buy the skis, or, you know, hire the trainer. It becomes kind of a rich white man's sport, if you will, you know, for the privileged, the wealthy. It's really hard to rectify how that is the case. And I will just contrast that with, say, maybe like Norway, where you get the most incredible cross-country skiers. Part of it is in the system I just described, but the other part is when you go to those schools, they're outside, it's cross-country ski equipment everywhere. All the kids have skied to school. So everybody, almost as a means of transportation, has skied to school. So you get all these kids skiing. Everyone's in the pool of learning to ski, knowing skiing, and then you get some that rise out of that, as opposed to it just being financially prohibitive for way too many people.
Well, again, when I... I have to tell you, one of the parts of the Olympics that I very much like is that opening ceremony with the parade of the athletes from the different country. Actually, you know, I thought this year was pretty bland, quite frankly, compared with some of the other ones. But when we talk about kind of the economic discrepancy, I mean, you know, you get Germany, you get the United States, which has hundreds of athletes, and then you get, you know, some countries who have three or four or even one, because there's just not the economic capacity to field a large group of athletes to compete.
Well, that's for certain. And the other thing that gets really wonky in that arena, pardon the pun, but there they built that arena. You know, what does it seat? 120,000 people. The burden, I believe, that's laid upon some of these cities that host, once the games are long gone and blown over, is like, what is that venue going to be used for, and how will they ever, how will they ever maintain it and deal with it? You know, but okay, so we erected it so that we could have a flashy, you know, ceremony for athletes walking in and athletes walking out. I think some of this is not sustainable. And so I'm kind of a Debbie Downer on the whole opening and closing ceremonies. I mean, I know it impacted me, but I just don't think at the cost that it is to the nations and things that it's worth it. I think coming together for our specific events, I don't know. You know, there's a lot. There's broken systems everywhere in the world.
Well, it's interesting. I was speaking with Rebecca Dussault, who is a American cross-country skier who competed in the 2006 Olympics. And we're talking about the sports, the Olympics, as being kind of a discipline, has a good relationship with the spiritual life and disciplining ourselves. We're talking about different aspects. But Rebecca, like I said, I'm not an athlete, but I was on the committee. It was a huge committee of of people who were, you know, bidding for New York. I think it was for the 2012 Summer Olympics that were there. And I do know, and maybe it was all show, but I do know in the documents that had to be prepared for that, you had to demonstrate how the investment you were making in those stadiums, in the infrastructure, all of that, were going to last beyond the Olympics. That was one of the criteria that they were judged on. Now, I can't tell you whether that was just for show and like they really didn't take it into consideration. But I was a little impressed back then that there was that concern to make sure that it was going to have more of an impact on the country going forward. But what you're saying, I think, is right. You know, you got to look at that stuff.
Yeah, and it's the individual areas. I mean, you're going to look at the populace of New York City, and that's a whole different thing than little Pyeongchang, which is quite small for boasting a venue of that size. And in my experience, I have frequented the 2002 Olympic cross-country venue, Soldier Hollow, and I have just watched them struggle and struggle and struggle to keep that venue alive. And it is incredible to ski there. Both from just a visual standpoint, anyone, just even a beginner who wanted to learn, would love to learn there, to the most advanced of racers coming back for races. And they just struggle all the time to keep that venue open. And it's a real issue. So I think on a larger scale, you know, this is just part of where we've got to keep sport in check, because as we make it God,
yep,
we let it run amok, and we see it over and over.
So, Rebecca, talk to me a little bit about the speaking that you do and the training that you do. And if somebody wanted to kind of get in touch with you to maybe ask you to speak or how would they do that?
Yeah, I'm easily found on social media. My tagline is Fit Catholic Mom. Also, my website is fitcatholicmom.com. Since the time of the Olympics in 2006 and various times when I came back to race after that, even a world championship that I won in 2010 in winter triathlon, all these things have sparked an interest in people hearing me speak on faithfulness and fitness. And how do you combine both? How do you, this day and age, rectify being totally and uniquely Catholic with also chasing fitness goals? And can those line up and be an all right combo? Well, I have to put it all together in that way. And I also tie in food and family, because those are some other great pillars we all deal with on a daily basis. But I go around the nation and speak, whether at women's conferences or high school youth groups. I mean, I've spoken all over the place, and I just love to share a message that helps people reintegrate health into their home, but with that Catholic perspective, because a lot of us have lost kind of the directive from the church on what sport is to look like. And so we don't ask, like, what does the church think of sport? We say, no, how does the church realize her mission within sport? Because sport's not going away. And we need to be plugged in at some level. We need that physical formation. But how does the church then realize her mission within that sport? Is it mission territory? What is our light we bring into each of our unique arenas within sport? So, I'm easily contacted. I go around this month. I speak in New York City, as we've already spoken of that city. I'll be there for a few Legatus events. I'm available for public speaking as well as personal training. I have such a heart that goes out to the Catholic mother who wants to reclaim her health, and she's balancing a lot. I mean, she needs to, let's say it, crush it every day in the world's hardest vocation. She has to raise saints, you know, no pressure, mama. But she has to raise saints every day.
But you know what, yeah. I say, but Rebecca, Rebecca, so I always, when everybody says, you know, we got saints. So we got St. Paul, right? And we got St. Paul who held the coat to kill the first martyr. We have Peter who denied Jesus and was called Satan by Peter. We have St. Augustine who didn't figure out he was going to turn his life around to the end. I got to say, it's not such a high bar to be a saint, at least in the Catholic Church.
Right. Well, it is nice when we have those examples. And one of the best ones I could draw in would be Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, who's my patron of all of my sports.
Got to tell you, Rebecca, he might be a patron, but he ain't made the top 10. But so tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he to me exemplifies how to be ordinary but live extraordinarily. He was just an average student. He disobeyed, I'm sure, his parents at times. He smoked cigars with his mom. She taught him how. He mountain climbed with his friends, and he even told his friends that he'd play pool with them, and if they lost, they had to go with him to Eucharistic adoration. So he kind of took those worldly means of being in the world but never of the world, and he just turned that up a notch and saw in his fellow man his mission, that he was to go and inspire and lead with the truth. And so everything from his late night excursions to go pray all night at the Europa Sanctuary, all the details of his life are so inspirational to me, because when I found out about him, I was 24. He had died at 24 from polio, from serving the poorest. And he was a cross-country skier. We have that picture of him with his ski bib on, he has number 25 on, all on his cross-country skis up at Bartonecchia, which was also one of the Olympic village sites for the Turin Games. And so I just connect with him. I realize that he is a brother in sport and in life, and I can look at him and say, sanctity is for all of us. It's for all of us to live in our vocation.
You know, Rebecca, what I think one of the things that you said a little bit earlier on is a very, very just clear example of what our core Christian belief is, that for whatever reason, God decided that we were going to be saved by Jesus in human form. And that, so therefore, there's nothing human that is outside the purview of spirituality, of grace, because Jesus came in human form to lead us to the Father, to save us. And so whatever is human is of concern to us, and we can find God's grace there, and we need to seek to make room for God's Spirit wherever it is, whether it be in sports or whether it be in music, whether it be in politics, whether it be wherever, that because we believe in an incarnation of God. And I think, you know, you epitomize that so well. So thanks for what you're doing.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I'll just say, too, I kind of have a beef with how much glory we give to athletes. You see it right now on the stage with the Olympics happening. But I always give props to those who are using their mind, their heart, their hands in equally or greater Olympic ways. You know, we have to all be Olympic athletes of the spirit first off. That's what the saints were. You know, you talk about people who had their game on, who were, you know, had their game face, they were ready to go. But the saints who showed up day in and day out to do the work, or to be at prayer, whatever it was. And so my heart goes out to all those who don't get that recognition simply because they're not, quote, athletes. Well, whatever you're doing in life, if you're doing it with your mind, if you're doing it in service, if you're doing it musically, whatever it is, do it athletically, do it heroically, do it Olympically. Olympically, there's a new word for you.
Rebecca Dussault, American cross-country skier in the 2006 Olympians. She is a fit mom. She is a trainer. She is a speaker. You can find her on our blogging at Fit Catholic Mom. And she's available. If you'd like her to come speak to your group, if you'd like to talk to her about maybe training, please get in touch with her. We shared for a little bit with her. I think you can see her passion, her commitment, and her ability to kind of communicate some very, very important things. So, Rebecca Dussault, thanks so much for being with us on Just Love.
Oh, you're welcome. The pleasure is all mine.
Great. So why don't we take a break as we are beginning our Lenten season, and we'll just be back in a few minutes. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We'll just be back in a minute on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world through our prism of Catholic thought, Catholic wisdom, just love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So we are beginning our Lenten season, and I want to remind everybody that, okay, for our Lenten season, we do have to undertake some acts to help us through this season. I was glad Rebecca talked about discipline and training compared with sport. And that's what Lent is, a little bit season of a little bit of discipline. I've grown to like it a whole lot because I think it's a change up of rhythm if we do it. If we don't do it, it doesn't make any difference. And a lot of people don't do it. But I got to tell you, when I did church this week on Ash Wednesday, usually the first Mass in the morning, 25 people. people, and I would say there were over 200 people on Ash Wednesday in the church. And actually, one of the persons who was in the church and got ashes was the former vice president, Joe Biden. So, you know, we have listed one Catholic politician who was getting his ashes on Ash Wednesday. I'm sure there are others, but I just know of the one who was in the church where I was this morning. So anyway, so we'll talk a little bit more about Lent a little bit later. But, you know, we don't want to forget the idea of the people who are suffering, who are migrants, who are refugees. Tom, bring us a little bit up to date on what's going on in Bangladesh with the and Miramar.
Sure, Monsignor. Well, you know, in Bangladesh, there has been thousands and thousands of refugees from Myanmar who are part of the Rohingya minority that have been coming over. Over 700,000 refugees are currently packed into refugee camps. They've been there since last year. They're dwarfing local populations. They're triggering an increasingly angry response from Bangladeshis who say the influx is causing, in their own country, food shortages, pushing up prices and undercutting wages. And Bangladeshi Refugee Relief Repatriation Commissioner Mohammed Al-Kalam said that the impact and toll on border cities such as Ukiah has been severe. Health systems.
But aren't they supposed to go back?
They are going to go back, Monsignor. I mean, and actually, it's interesting. Just earlier this week on Tuesday, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, wound up talking to the Security Council about, you know, about that. And he began to address that, to talk a little bit about those almost 700,000 Rohingya that have fled the violence. And what he said is it's time to bring an end to repeated devastating cycles of violence, displacement, and statelessness. The UN's trying to grapple with several issues at once: violence by the Myanmar military against ethnic minorities, and the overwhelming difficulties of mass exodus of the Rohingya. They're currently in the process of trying to repatriate them, but unfortunately, it's taking time to come up with the actual ability to do that once a year.
Tom, you know, I mean, I think one of the things you got to do in order to understand what's going on in the world is just to, like, figure it out and say, yuck, it's not good. I mean, isn't this a situation, I correct me if I'm wrong, that the Rohingya are Muslims, right?
Yes, they are.
And the majority in Myanmar are Buddhists, right?
That is correct, Monsignor, yes.
And so we have a religious conflict. And again, I mean, I think to the ordinary listener, to me, we kind of have an image in our mind of Buddhists being very peace-loving, very tranquil, very calm. We don't tend to think of them as kind of taking action against another religious group. That's not our image, right, Tom?
Oh, exactly, Monsignor. You know, I mean, so often people will think that, and you always see, you know, the image of the Buddha just, you know, kind of sitting and very peaceful. But in this situation, unfortunately, there has been tremendous violence that's been going on since last August, when Myanmar security forces, again majority Buddhist, have began a scorch earth campaign against Rohingya villages.
So, you know, what I want to suggest, Tom, is, and by no means do I want to pick on Buddhists, but what I do want to do is pick on all religions, including Christianity, including Islam, including Judaism, that we all have the capacity to go get off track. We all have the capacity to act in ways that are not faithful to our deep beliefs, and a lot of evil comes in, and sometimes it manifests itself in persecution of other groups. And, you know, clearly there have been so much in the media these days about what's going on in the Middle East and some of the radical, or the fundamentalist or deviant Islam that's persecution of Christians that are there. And, you know, we know some of the stuff that's going on in refugee camps and places like that, which are really not good situations. And we have examples in various places and different times in history when Christians were not tolerant of others and persecuted others. So I think I think one of the things we should try to think about this Lent is maybe in part of our prayer, our fasting, our sacrifice, how do we pray for, how do we sacrifice so that there can be a diminution of religious intolerance and that there can be a greater reconciliation. So it just seems to me that might be something worth our consideration, worth our prayer and our sacrifice this Lent. Hey, Tom, you were down in Washington, D.C. at the annual Social Ministries Gathering. Can you tell people who don't know what that means a little bit about what it means?
Sure, Monsignor. Well, the Social Ministry Gathering is a annual gathering that's sponsored by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Department of Justice, Peace, and Human Development. And it brings together, I'd say this year, probably about 500 ministers who come from around the country. They do generally justice and peace work. They do other charitable work at Catholic Charities agencies or other agencies around the country. And also this year, we had a significant contingent of younger people who were there, Monsignor. Many came from
Tom, when
colleges.
when you say ministers, you don't mean they were ordained Protestant people.
No, Monsignor. Fine. I mean lay ministers in the Catholic sense, although there are a significant number of women religious and priests who do attend as well.
Right.
And then there's also we had a great number of students, which was great to see the youth in the room, a great number of students who wound up coming. Actually, the representation this year was pretty significant. There were over 100 dioceses represented from 45 states.
Okay, so yeah. That's pretty good. Was there an overall theme or a mood or a sense of the meeting? Because you've been to a few of them, right?
There was, Monsignor. Yeah, I mean, this one was on building. The title of it was "Building Community: The Call to the Common Good," and I think, Monsignor, basically in this context, what it was really calling us to was to kind of remember those on the margins. I think particularly it was to call people to remember the poor and the vulnerable. And in a particular way, we also made trips to Capitol Hill, Monsignor. We also went over to visit our state senators and our congresspeople on that Tuesday.
Did you remind them to that they should get their ashes?
Oh, well, actually, it was earlier than Ash Wednesday.
I can tell by that answer. You didn't.
I didn't.
You're
I didn't,
right?
Monsignor.
Okay.
Although I will say that the two of the people that I saw were not Catholic. They were not Christian.
I got to tell you, I just reminded one of my favorite hosts on Sirius Satellite, Jenny McCarthy. I saw her on the way out, and I said, Jenny, you don't have your ashes yet. You better get your ashes for Ash Wednesday.
That's right, exactly.
And I said, what's with the blue hair?
Oh,
she's got blue hair
now
because she wanted to make a statement when she went to the the Grammys.
I thought maybe it was for Lent, Monsignor. I wasn't sure.
No, it was before that.
Anyway,
so let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the presidency with James O'Toole, who is a professor at Boston College, since it's President's Weekend. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, your neighbor, and yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. It's President's Weekend, and arguably what we came back with is one of the most recognizable pieces of music, Hail to the Chief. And that's a good lead-in to our next guest, Professor James O'Toole, who is a professor of history at Boston College, and he's taught quite a bit on American Catholicism. And we're going to speak with him a little bit about the American presidency. Particularly, we're going to talk a little bit about the only Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, and how does religion kind of play out in then? And maybe we'll look at John F. Kennedy, and then we'll come a little bit closer to the present. And so why don't we begin by just listening to the most famous speech about religion that John F. Kennedy gave to a bunch of people in Texas. The speech he gave was talking about his own Catholic faith to a Baptist group. Can we listen to the clip?
Contrary to common newspaper usage, I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me. Whatever issue may come before me as president, if I should be elected, on birth control, divorce, censorship, gambling, or any other subject, I will make my decision in accordance with these views, in accordance with what my conscience tells me to be in the national interest, and without regard to outside religious pressure or dictates. And no power or threat of punishment could cause me to decide otherwise. But if the time should ever come, and I do not concede any conflict to be remotely possible, when my office would require me to either violate my conscience or violate the national interest, then I would resign the office. And I hope any other conscientious public servant would do likewise. But I do not intend to apologize for these views to my critics of either Catholic or Protestant faith. Nor do I intend to disavow either my views or my church in order to win this election. If I should lose on the real issues, I shall return to my seat in the Senate, satisfied that I tried my best and was fairly judged. But if this election is decided on the basis that 40 million Americans lost their chance of being president on the day they were baptized.
That was the speech that John F. Kennedy gave on September 12th, 1960, at the Greater Houston Ministerial Association. I'm delighted to welcome to Just Love Professor James O'Toole, Professor of History at Boston College. Professor O'Toole, thank you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Thanks very much, Monsignor Sullivan.
I'm old enough to remember parts of that speech. It was kind of refreshing. It was good to hear it again. I'm sure you have looked at that speech professionally in a variety of ways.
I have looked at that speech and listened to it any number of times, and I'm also old enough to have some memory of it when it was given. The issues that were settled with President Kennedy's election in 1960 seem now so settled that we can forget, I think, how important it was and even necessary it was for him to give that speech to assure voters who might be skeptical, and there were many of them, that a Catholic really could be the president and that wouldn't damage the country.
Yes, it was. I mean, it really does seem to be a very, very kind of different era than we're living in today, I think.
That's right. When John Kennedy ran for president in 1960, a Catholic had been the nominee of one of the major parties only once before, in 1928, when Al Smith, the governor of New York, ran for president, and he lost in a landslide. And one of the aspects of that campaign that was particularly ugly was that there was a lot of overt anti-Catholic sentiment that was expressed by Smith's opponents, and all kinds of tall tales that if Smith the Catholic were elected, one of the first things he would do would be to build a tunnel from Washington to Rome so that the Pope could send his secret instructions back and forth telling the President of the United States what to do. Obviously silly, but enough people believed it that...
Some of us believe it's almost as silly as trying to build a wall, but that's another topic, okay?
That is another topic.
Right.
I'm a historian. I deal with the past.
Okay. But anyway, so let's put this in a little context. But, you know, I've listened to some of the talks that George Bush, baby Bush, not Papa Bush, gave. And in some of the ways that he spoke, he almost had to say he was a believing, born-again Christian to kind of demonstrate his bona fides with certain groups in the country.
That's true. It's an enduring issue for American public life. To what extent should one's religious beliefs shape one's public policy? I myself think that we can't completely divorce these things. People have political ideas, they have moral issues that they care about because of their religious beliefs. Those can't be completely divorced from public policy. At the same time, there's got to be an institutional separation between church and state. And as President Kennedy said, if any individual public figure ever feels a conflict there, it would be his duty to resign.
Well, you know, I think what before President John F. Kennedy said is a very kind of clear statement. But, I throw out as my hypothesis is that I think we're in a different age now, as I said before, where, for a certain part of the electorate, they don't want a dichotomy between one's faith and public policy. They want their faith to drive public policy. And I think that's some of the problems we get in the current political environment.
I think that's probably the case. As I say, it's been a problem for American government, American public life, as long as the country has been a country. Again, we don't want to rule out moral considerations and trying to get those put into effect in public policy. You know, Martin Luther King fought against the segregation system clearly on the basis of his religious beliefs. I think we would all say that was good, that was right. That was a real accomplishment. At the same time, it's got to be broadly based. It can't be narrowly denominational. It can't be narrowly on some issues and not others. Interestingly, in the questions and answers that followed President Kennedy's speech to the Houston ministers, it was a very short Q&A period afterwards. And one of the ministers said to him, well, then Senator Kennedy, you've articulated a view of the separation of church and state. Will you now tell the Pope to make that official for all Catholics everywhere? In a way, I think the minister was trying to trap Kennedy a little bit, but Kennedy very artfully and rightly said, well, I'm not going to let the Pope tell me what to do, and so I'm not going to tell him what to do. But that in and of itself is a measure of the potential hostility that was there.
Yeah, I think you point that out very clearly that hostility that was that was there. And the thing that I find fascinating about the speech that Kennedy gave, given when it was given the insertion of some moral values, moral opinions that have been part of the debate, the religious debate, the political debate, for the past 30, 40 years. So this is a trick question. You're a professor. You usually get to ask the questions, but I get to ask the question. What was the thing in 1960 that apparently wasn't even on the radar screen that he did not mention as a potential conflict issue?
Well, the issues that became very prominent subsequently in this area, issues like abortion, for example,
was just not a matter.
This was that election was 13 years before the Roe v. Wade decision. Mm. And state laws were beginning to change here and there on the subject of abortion, but it certainly was not a political issue as it subsequently became.
That was the thing that struck me when I listened again to that speech. Didn't even get mentioned. And you know, my own hypothesis right now is that it is for very different reasons. It's a real challenge for a Catholic politician to run and get elected for president. I'm not saying whether it should be, shouldn't be. All I'm saying, it's a real challenge because, you know, if you take our middle of the road Catholic beliefs, we don't feel at home in any of the mainstream political parties. And that makes it a really difficult moment, I think, that we're in.
Yes, I think that's true for many people. The change that's happened in 1960, some people were prepared to be critical of President Kennedy for being too Catholic, that he was going to take church teaching and try to put them into effect in the United States. The fear was he was going to be too Catholic. In 2004, when John Kerry ran for president, the only other Catholic to be a major party nominee for president since 1960, when John Kerry ran, the criticism of him came as much from Catholics who thought of him, particularly on the abortion issue, thought of him as being not Catholic enough. And I think that's the change that's happened in the interim.
Yes, and it seems to me it you're right, and I think that is precisely the case, and I think it's a real dilemma that we have because, you know, as Cardinal Bernardine would have probably articulated as well as anybody, when you talk about kind of a consistent or a seamless ethic of life, boy, it certainly cuts across both political parties these days.
That's absolutely true, and I think you're right in saying that to some extent, Catholics who are concerned about these issues are fully at home in neither of the parties.
Yeah, it is. So, what do you make of one of the things that we noted last week that we have now these national prayer breakfasts, and sometimes there's prayer breakfasts held at the White House. I'm a little bit ambivalent as to whether or not I think they're good things or not good things. What you got a thought about that?
Yeah, the National Prayer Breakfast, as we have it, was really an invention of the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s. The period of the 1950s, right after the Second World War, was a very highly religious era in American history. Rates of church attendance, rates of church membership, and so on, all as high as they've ever been. They've declined since then. But in the 1950s, there were things like the National Prayer Breakfast. It was at that point that In God We Trust was put on the money. It was in that period that the phrase Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. So in the 1950s, there was that upsurge of religious feeling, although it was very broad and kind of non-denominational. President Eisenhower, there's a famous quote from President Eisenhower saying, "America means nothing unless it's founded on a firm faith in God, and I don't care what it is."
Yep.
The kind of generalized sense of that religion is a good thing for people and the country as a whole.
Kind of a civic religion.
A civic religion, not in any specific denominational kind of sense. And I think the National Prayer Breakfast is a continuation of that. Whether or not the form is one that still speaks today, I think that's another question. I've never been to one. I've often wondered how much praying actually goes on in the National Prayer Breakfast.
I went to one. Well, maybe it wasn't that. I don't know. I went to a prayer breakfast a number of years ago, the last years of Bill Clinton. It was in the White House. Uh-huh. So I'm not sure if that was a national prayer breakfast or something else. And we did have a moment of prayer. So well, anyway, <that's good. laughs> Professor James O'Toole, thanks for being with us on our kind of President's Weekend show. And thanks for being with us. And best of luck with your teaching and with your writing. Thanks for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you very much.
Professor James O'Toole, who is a professor of history at Boston College, and we kind of had the opportunity to speak with him about the changing kind of role of religion in presidential politics. So, President's Day, first week of Lent, and I just want to remind our listeners, change the pace. So take the time to do something to change your life. So I'll tell you one thing I did today, okay? My job makes me have to know something's going on in government because we do a lot in partnership with government. But I got to tell you, and I think any of our listeners know, I become very frustrated by just the nonsense going on in politics, particularly in Washington. And so one of the things I'm doing for Lent is I used to listen to a station that covered a lot of the political news. No more, not for Lent. For Lent, I changed the station in my car, and I'm listening to one of those Christian music stations, which I like. I don't remember which one, but I decided that was something I was going to do to kind of remove myself from some of the things that kind of upset me a little bit and to focus on some other things. So you do whatever you do in your own life. But the only thing I don't want to let any of our listeners off the hook, you can't not do things seriously for Lent. And I got to say, you got to do three parts of that, as I say all the time. You got to do more praying. You got to do more discipline, sacrifice, fasting, and you got to do more charity. You got to do those three things, change up the ordinary pattern of life and pick something that you're going to do. And it does make sense to do it consistently. Can't just do it once because that doesn't change the rhythm or the pattern. And what it's about is being able to enter more deeply into that Paschal mystery at the end of Lent at that time. So thanks for being with us on Just Love as we begin Lent. President's Weekend, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us again on Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.